Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how the two Republican frontrunners will do in a matchup with President Obama. Alan Lichtman, the distinguished professor of history at American University, joins us. He is the author of The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way of Predicting the Next President, a system that has correctly predicted all U.S. presidential outcomes since 1984. Then we will look into the intense religiosity of Rick Santorum that pundits argue cost him the election in Michigan and make him unelectable in a general election. Meanwhile, at the state level, much of Santorum's extreme positions on social issues are being voted into law in legislatures in Virginia, Alabama, and Oklahoma, and will be voted on tomorrow in the United States Senate. Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values, joins us. Then finally, we'll look into the new nukes for food deal with North Korea with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus. He was a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and taught at Sungkyunkwo University in Seoul, South Korea, and is the author of North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. Joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studies both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And after the last night's primaries in Arizona and Michigan, with Romney narrowly winning in Michigan and soundly winning in Arizona, what's your predictions in terms of a Romney versus Obama race, if that's to be?
Well, I first issued my prediction for the general election of 2012 in January 2010. Nearly 3 years before the election. And as early as that, it was pretty clear to me that the keys to the White House were lining up in favor of the incumbent Democratic Party. There are 13 keys. They are simple true-false questions that look at the state of the country and the strength of the party holding the White House, basically saying the White House is won or lost by what the party in power does, and there's little the opposition can do to change the verdict. It looks at things like third parties, whether the sitting president is running, whether there's a contest for the incumbent party nomination, policy change, social unrest, scandal, foreign policy successes and failures, and of course the long and the short-term economy. And it takes six of these factors to count out the party in power. In January of 2010, I had four down against the party holding the White House. Now I only have three down. In other words, remarkably, prospects have gotten a little bit better for the party in power, mainly because Barack Obama has had some very splashy successes in foreign affairs, eliminating bin Laden, eliminating Gaddafi, liberating Libya, while at the same time he hasn't had any big setbacks, no scandals, no major social unrest. Of course, there's been the Occupy movement, the Tea Party, but nothing like millions of people out in the streets in the 1960s, the city burning. And of course, it's now clear there's no opposition to him, and that certainly doesn't look like there's a major Ross Perot-type third party on the horizon. So even with the sour economy, which certainly counts against him, the kinds of circumstances that favor the party in power now stand in favor of the incumbent Democrats, whether it's Romney or anyone else.
Well, of course, in the Michigan primary, Santorum encouraged Democrats to cross over in the open primary and vote for him. And the assumption is that a lot of Democrats feel that Santorum is easier to beat than Romney. But in many ways, they represent the sort of heart and the head of the Republican Party. And it would seem that just as Santorum may well have sabotaged himself by dissing JFK and bringing up contraception and homeschooling and the idea that going to college is some kind of a form of elitism, all of this crazy stuff apparently played well. But the more that one sees Romney in comparison to Santorum, the more I think it's a stark choice for the Republicans between the passions of the right and this kind of corporatist CEO whose speech last night was like listening to a corporate presentation. And frankly, if he is to become president, he'll be the CEO and his press secretary will report to the American people. He doesn't do press conferences, you know. He doesn't do the Sunday talk shows, this guy.
Well, you know, Romney is famous for saying corporations are people, and he lives that. He is the living, breathing embodiment of the soulless, passionless, inspirationalist, if that's a word, corporation. You know, nobody but nobody, including, you know, loyal Republicans, are willing to walk through a brick wall for Mitt Romney. There are those who think he's okay. There are those who think, you know, because he's so bland that he might give Barack Obama more of a challenge than someone who's kind of on the acid side of the right. And, you know, all of that may be correct, but this guy will absolutely be a cog in the corporate machine once he becomes elected. Of course, I don't think that's going to happen. But let me make it clear, though. When it comes to economic policy, they're all peas in the same pod. They all are against regulation. They all want deregulation. They all want to kill off the EPA. They all want to balloon the deficit by cutting taxes, which are going to mostly benefit the corporations and the wealthy. They're no different when it comes to the policy that benefit the rich and benefit the corporations. You know, conservatives talk a good game about being for limited government and fiscal responsibility and free markets. They're nothing of the kind. There's no fiscal responsibility in their programs. They are going to profligately increase the deficit. Remember, the big deficit increasers were the two most conservative presidents since World War II, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. So there's no fiscal responsibility. There's no limited government. I mean, to do what they want to do, to, you know, toss out the supposedly undocumented immigrants, to police, you know, every time a woman wants to have a reproductive decision, they're going to have an army of police and federal bureaucrats to do that. To promote their foreign policy, their, you know, war against drugs, they're going to have an army of police forces. It's not about big government versus small government. They're only against big government when it comes to regulating the abuses of business or providing social welfare. They're all for big government when it comes to providing corporate welfare, all these special tax breaks and export guarantees to the big corporations, when it comes to police and military forces.
Well, obviously, it would be good, I think, to have a referendum on the religious right if Santorum were to be the candidate. That way you would be able to sort of test the limits of the America's theocratic constituency. And on the other hand, it might be useful to have a corporatist to see how bringing into stark relief the 99% versus the 1%. It's difficult to know in terms of choosing your poison, which would be the most salutary lesson for the American electorate, or conversely, which would be the most dangerous if one of them got elected.
Both dangerous, and I'm not sure they're that different. You know, maybe you don't believe what Mitt Romney says, but on the social issues, with the exception of contraception, but on abortion, on immigration, on gay marriage rights, he is as far to the right as Rick Santorum, at least in terms of what he is saying now. He is trying to portray himself as, you know, an epitomal, social, right-wing conservative. If you read my book, I talk in my book about the fact that the core values of conservatism are the social conservatism, what they consider to be white Christian values, and economic conservatism, not free markets. I mean, my God, for most of this 20th century, they were for protective tariffs, and they're still for all kinds of corporate protections and corporate welfare, but private enterprise. And at least in terms of what they are saying, they're both saying the same things about both of those sides of the conservative coin. Again, you may not believe that Mitt Romney has his heart in it when it comes to the social issues. We know he has his heart, soul, and pocketbook in it when it comes to conservative economic issues. But nonetheless, the Republican Party as a whole has moved so far to the right that the price of admission is to be an extremist on the social issue, just to get in the door.
Well, the thing that the difference from my point of view, and perhaps it's just coming at it from a journalistic point of view, is that I find that Santorum is a more accessible, open candidate. He's so open to the point where he can't stop his own theocratic impulses, and he may well have stepped in it by particularly saying some of the more outrageous things about how JFK makes him throw up, which doesn't go down well with Catholic voters.
Go after our one Catholic president and you're a Catholic candidate.
Right.
But you're right. It's because he is not scripted.
Right.
He's not a plastic man like Mitt Romney. He's a real person. You may not like the person that he is, but he is a real person who actually says, at least up to now, what he believes. You know, once the consultants and the ad men and the hucksters, you know, remold him, he may become more plastic and less accessible, you know, given the fact that his open mouth so far has done nothing but attract flies.
Well, but the other guy, though, conversely, is not just scripted. He reads from the teleprompter. He doesn't make impromptu speeches. Whenever he says anything impromptu, it's usually a gaffe, like his wife having two Cadillacs and how only he doesn't know anything about NASCARs, and he's not a fan, but he does have friends who own NASCAR teams.
Right.
And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But what I find really offensive and would be chilling, I think, to have a president like this is the extent to which he will not expose himself to the press, to have press conferences, and to even go on the Sunday shows. He goes on Fox, and that's it.
And who knows today who is the CEO of Exxon? Who can tell you? You know, the biggest, most powerful corporation. No one knows who that CEO is. That CEO does not expose himself to the press, does not say things candidly and openly. And you're going to have the president in the mode of the CEO of Exxon, if in fact Mitt Romney is the president. And, you know, the open question about Mitt Romney, too, is what does he really believe? It is impossible to tell because he has, you know, shifted his position so many times and seems willing to say whatever is necessary to get elected. I don't understand why the guy wants to be president. Usually you want to be president because you have some kind of convictions. I'm not sure he has any convictions other than, you know, I really want to be president as kind of a capstone of my career. It's not clear I want to be president because I fervently believe in certain things and want to implement them as, you know, the commander-in-chief and head of the executive branch of the American government.
Well, as I say, he comes across when he was talking last night, where he spends all his time, you know, just sort of penny-ante attacks on Obama, reflexive, but very hollow, sort of
stuff,
false,
right.
False anger and phony passion. But it all feels like a guy making an IPO, you know, initial public offering pitch to a bunch of Wall Street investment bankers, you know.
I agree with that, and, you know, that's why it's strange why he wants to be president, other than, you know, kind of the capstone of his career. You know, he's been a CEO, now he wants to be the biggest CEO.
Let me again remind the audience I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. And this battle, of course, is over for the presidency. It's all about winning the American right. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. And this system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. That on the one hand, you can make the argument that Santorum is, you know, his runaway mouth because he so passionately believes in homeschooling and, you know, American madrasas, if you will, and women should not have access to birth control, et cetera, and showing off his six kids at every opportunity, et cetera. As much as you can suggest that maybe it's not going to play to a national audience, and that's what all the pundits say, that, you know, it may work for the right-wing Christian right constituency of the Republican primary voters, but it's not going to work in a general election. Meanwhile, how do you explain how the same constituency that Santorum represents is having so many electoral successes at the state level? Look what's just happened in Virginia. Look what's happening in Alabama with all these personhood and these invasive procedures on women, basically forcing them, trying to guilt them into not having an abortion by unnecessary medical measures that are both expensive and completely counterindicated.
Yeah, no, this message is very powerful, but I think it is powerful not with the majority, but with a very passionate minority who, of course, tends to be overrepresented in the South, which is why you see so many of these measures in places like Virginia and Alabama. You don't see them in Illinois or New York or California or other places. But, you know, this idea of who is electable and who isn't is a lot of nonsense. You don't know who's electable. You don't know who can win and or who can't win. And my system, which, as you noted, has been right for seven elections in a row, says it really doesn't matter who the challenging party nominates. That's just one out of 13 keys. What really matters to the American people is how well the party in power has governed. And this idea of electability is sheer nonsense. Look at the Democrats in 2004. John Kerry was there, Mitt Romney. Nobody loved John Kerry. He wasn't exciting any passions. No one was willing to swim the Atlantic Ocean for him. Howard Dean was the guy who inspired passion. But the electorate went with John Kerry because they thought he was electable. And, of course, not only did he lose, but he is roundly condemned today for running a miserable campaign. I don't think that's true. If you look at it, he won all three debates, for example. But he still lost because the state of the country in 2004 was not quite yet bad enough for the American people to reject the party in power. So I always tell everyone, whether you're on the right or the left, throw out the whole notion of electability. If I had to abolish any given word from the language, it would be electability. And vote for who you believe in. If you believe in the corporatism of Mitt Romney, by all means, vote for Mitt Romney. If you believe in the theocratic approach of Rick Santorum, by all means, vote for Rick Santorum. But you're leading yourself down the primrose path if you believe you can judge who's electable and who isn't.
Well, of course, that's not going to stop the press from their honing in on this process, this electoral process, which here we are both guilty of following it. And indeed, we are about to, in a week's time, have Super Tuesday, which, of course, is going to be incredibly hyped up. And there appears to be a real possibility of a fairly long and bruising battle all the way to Tampa, Republican convention, with 437 electoral votes up for grab. A lot of these states that are being contested next Tuesday, Tennessee, Georgia, Virginia, Oklahoma, they're pretty much Bible Belt states, aren't they? You're gonna have Gingrich hoping for some kind of resurrection, and Santorum basically saying now it's a two-man race. It's possible that Romney's not going to do well on Super Tuesday, isn't it?
It's very possible. As you say, Gingrich could appeal to the Bible Belt, although, you know, social conservative voters never seem to care about your personal morality. It doesn't matter if you're a philanderer, if you treated women miserably, so long as you say the right things, it seems to appeal to them. Look at Senator David Vitter is still in office, still winning handily, even though, you know, he has been fairly well established to be patronizing prostitutes, and yet he's still a family value candidate. So they don't seem to care how you live your life. They only seem to care what you say. And Gingrich could do well. Santorum could do very well in Ohio, which is, you know, next door to Pennsylvania. And this could be a long, bruising battle, but it doesn't matter. Everyone talks about, oh, you know, all the Republicans are wringing their hair about the long, bruising battle. The longest and most bruising battle in the history of the Republican Party was 1952, when the moderate, similar to this, although different issues, the moderate Dwight Eisenhower was up against the champion of the conservatives, Senator Robert Taft. Not only did they fight throughout the primary season, and there weren't as many primaries then, a lot of delegates were chosen by party bosses, but that battle went right down to the convention and was only decided in Eisenhower's favor when he won a credentials battle over the delegates from Texas. And the conservatives were furious. They called it the Texas Steal. Taft was so furious it took quite some time for him to endorse Eisenhower. And that rankled for conservatives for decades. And guess what? Eisenhower won that election in a near landslide.
Well, but that's often cited, I think, erroneously by people who keep saying, oh, there's going to be some, you know, man on a white horse is going to rescue the Republican ticket from its fratricide.
That is very erroneous.
Because that's
Eisenhower fought the whole way.
Right.
And new person came in.
Right. But Eisenhower, I mean, Taft actually had more votes, delegates going in, didn't he?
That's right. It was only when Eisenhower, because the Texas delegation was actually awarded to Taft by the Taft Majority Central Committee of Texas, even though Eisenhower won the caucuses, and that decision was reversed. But no one came in to that convention. That never happens.
Right, but it's so pervasive that people think that somebody can be anointed as opposed to earning it the old-fashioned way, which is getting the actual votes. The idea that
never happened in modern history.
Exactly.
The only example, really, of that is someone who, you know, came in late was Hubert Humphrey, who came in very late. But that was a very special circumstance, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, who looked like he was heading to be the nominee after he won California. And, of course, Hubert Humphrey lost. Adlai Stevenson in 52 didn't contest the primaries. You go back to that election, and he lost handily. There's no example in modern history of a convention going down, you know, to the wire in the modern era of primary battles, deciding the election, and someone who hasn't been tested at all coming in and saving the party. No modern day example of that. In fact, Republicans ought to be chastened by the fact that if someone comes in, they haven't been, as you say, tested and scrutinized. And look what happened to candidates like Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, Herman Cain, who at first blush, you know, looked terrific. You know, they swept a lot of the electorate. And then, lo and behold, they couldn't withstand the scrutiny. Are you going to try that with a brand new nominee who hasn't had the scrutiny that only comes with a presidential campaign and risk having that scrutiny not come in the primary process when you can flush them out, but in the general election when you're stuck with them?
Well, Alan Lichtman, I guess if we didn't do anything else today, at least we clarified that ridiculous canard that's floating around that somebody, Jeb Bush, is going to come in at the last minute and rescue the Republicans. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studies both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Republican war on women. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, who is the senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and The UK Guardian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thanks for having me.
And there is, of course, just a postmortem in terms of the Republican primary in Michigan and Arizona, particularly in Michigan, where Rick Santorum, according to the punditry, put his foot in his mouth. Not that Romney hasn't done that, but but in particular, by bringing up the Christian right social issues, particular homeschooling and contraception, his opposition to contraception, lambasting President John Kennedy over his First Amendment attitudes, to which Santorum objected so much that he said he wanted to throw up. So all of that was a little bizarre. A lot of people are saying, well, he's blown it. He'll never make it in a national campaign. He might appeal to the right wing Christian right voters in the Republican primary, but on a national campaign, this is not going to work. But on the other hand, the agenda that he's talking about seems to be working across the country. In Virginia, they've just passed onerous restrictions on a woman's right to choose and forcing medical procedures on women that they don't want. They're about to do that in Alabama. So give us a sense of what's going on here. On the one hand, we're told that Santorum is not going to make it on the national stage, yet his agenda is making it throughout the states.
Right. Well, even though a presidential candidate at the national level might not be able to garner enough votes to win an election running on that kind of agenda, nonetheless, at the state level, conservatives have had success in populating state legislatures, enabling them to pass these restrictive bills on abortion issues and even on contraception, you know, with banning family planning funding and from the state and so on. What's happening in Virginia and Alabama right now is actually part of a trend that has been going on across the country over the past 2 or 3 years. There are several other states that have passed these ultrasound laws, even ones that don't explicitly require the transvaginal probe, but may implicitly require that just because of the time of gestation to even do an effective ultrasound, you'd have to do that. And Texas has such a law, and it was challenged in court, and the Fifth Circuit upheld it as constitutional. This is part of a trend nationwide. There were, I guess, just a sequence of events that led to the outrage in Virginia, that led to the legislature stripping the part about the transvaginal probe requirement. But nonetheless, the bill still passed in its form requiring an ultrasound in the first place.
Well, all of these things are so transparently designed to humiliate women who are about to have an abortion.
Without the transvaginal probe, obviously, right? So it's meant to humiliate women and also to indicate to them that they're being punished for something. So, for example, in Texas, where there is an ultrasound law in place, that law was an amendment to a 2003 law called a right to know law. And these are pretty common. They've been passed in a number of states across the country, too. And these laws require the doctor to inform, quote unquote, a woman seeking an abortion of possible negative consequences of having an abortion. Now, many of these things have been disproved by medical evidence, such as the increased risk of breast cancer, depression, anxiety, and so on and so forth from having an abortion. Nonetheless, it's codified in the law that the doctor has to tell the woman all of these things before she can have an abortion. So in Texas, the ultrasound piece of it was kind of like an add-on to that already humiliating, degrading requirement that you have to be lectured about these possible consequences, which haven't even been medically proven, and in some cases have been medically disproven.
Again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, who is senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in the American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and the UK's Guardian. The other aspect of this kind of return to, you read an article recently at Religion Dispatches about the Republicans' return to the Dark Ages, and it, in many ways, for a lot of women, I think it feels like a return to the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. They thought that they had contraception was no longer an issue that was fought out in the 20s and 30s. Tomorrow in the United States Senate, they will be voting on legislation proposed by Senator Roy Blunt that would allow employers to deny coverage for health care services that are considered morally objectionable, and those include contraception. The battle continues. I mean, and again, I'm sort of perplexed that we're told that Santorum's fundamentalism is not going to play on the national stage, but yet the United States Senate is voting on his agenda.
Well, on the House side of the Congress, yesterday there was yet another hearing, this time held by the House Judiciary Committee, framing the contraception coverage requirement as a battle between, you know, executive overreach, the overreach of the Obama administration, and religious freedom, portraying it as an infringement of religious freedom. And it was not as lopsided as the hearings that the Oversight Committee held a few weeks ago that notoriously didn't have any women on the panels. This time they took, the Republicans took care to populate the panel with women, women who were opposed to the contraception mandate, by the way. But they did allow a Democrats to call a witness, and this was a public health witness who was on the Institute of Medicine committee that recommended the contraception coverage requirement in the first place. Nonetheless, I mean, the Republicans control the House of Representatives. They have, down the line, taken up this issue as one of an infringement of religious freedom. Even Republicans who aren't Catholic, even Republicans who don't share the Catholic Church's opposition to birth control. So yesterday you had this spectacle in a congressional hearing room of Daryl Issa, who's not Catholic himself, putting the Humanae Vitae, the 1968 papal encyclical that banned the use of, or, you know, said that the use of birth control was contrary to Catholic teaching, into the congressional record. So they've really taken up this cause. They don't have the majority in the Senate, and it's unclear whether the overbroad, blunt amendment will pass, but this is indicative of how far they're willing to stretch this religious freedom argument. It started as, well, we don't want Catholic hospitals and universities to have to provide this coverage, even though the original regulation exempted churches themselves from having to provide this coverage. And so then when Obama made this accommodation, that still wasn't good enough. And then they started making arguments, well, yes, well, originally we said we were concerned about Catholic hospitals and universities having to provide this coverage, but now we're concerned about the owner of a Taco Bell franchise who has a moral objection to this coverage, and what about him? And so they kept changing the parameters and changing the goalposts so that now you have the Blunt Amendment, which would basically allow, if it passed, allow any kind of employer to raise a religious conscience objection to not just the contraception coverage, but other coverage. You know, maybe they might not want to cover HIV drugs or something of that nature. So the Blunt Amendment is incredibly overbroad, and not only would permit an employer to not cover a wide array of medical care, but it also expands the idea of religious conscience objection far beyond what's ever been acknowledged or held by the Supreme Court or any other court in this country.
Well, but Sarah Posner, isn't there, they're using religiosity as an excuse for putting through this kind of reactionary agenda, and in terms of the anti-abortion requirements that have come that have been voted into law in Virginia and about to be voted into law in Alabama. And by the way, we didn't mention that Oklahoma the state of Oklahoma has pretty much passed its personhood amendment. That'll be signed by the governor soon. Mm-hmm. The Senate voted 34-8 in favor, and it's just a question of the Republican governor signing it into law. That'll be the first state in the country to enact a personhood bill. But just to touch on what seems to be the real motive here is in the case of these ultrasound bills are to humiliate women who need an abortion and want to have an abortion. And the way that they do it is not just the forced humiliation of having to be lectured to and look at ultrasound, but they have to pay for it. That's the key. It's in Roy Blunt's bill, what's going to happen is all of these companies that are going to be exempted now from basic health care provisions will mean that in terms of just contraception, which is what they're focusing on, women pay average in this country about $15 to $50 a month for contraception,
right,
even with insurance, that is.
Right.
But if the Blunt bill passes the Senate, it could go up to $600 a year. And, you know, we know American families are struggling, you know, to pay their bills in any case. Isn't
right.
that the agenda here? I mean, if they're using moralism as a way to punish women at the pocketbook.
Well, you know, they're claiming that it violates someone else's religious freedom if you are using the... They're saying that it violates the employer's religious freedom, or the CEO's even religious freedom, if they're forced to pay for your birth control or pay for coverage, insurance coverage. They don't have
didn't Obama exempt these religious organizations from that
by putting the onus on the insurance company? And again,
right.
like I said, they changed the goalposts. They made it seem like, well, no, it's not just that. Like we. Some employers self-insure, which means that they don't go through an insurance company. They provide the insurance directly to their employees, and so that wasn't acceptable. And they also made arguments about just sort of being in any way involved with an insurer who provides that kind of coverage. But, yeah, I mean, like, obviously, if you're going to make these attenuated, strained arguments about if you contract with an insurance carrier who provides this kind of coverage to women, that somehow tramples on your religious freedom, it really exposes what's underneath your argument, that it's really about you really don't want women to have birth control because, you know, otherwise why do you care about this so much? Like, why is it so important to you to not, you know, have any kind of connection at all to the insurance carrier who provides this coverage?
But isn't this the same kind of hypocrisy that is behind this idea on the part of the Christian right, who honestly believe they're some kind of beleaguered minority in this country that are you know repressed, you know, like, you know, the Shia
are minority, but they're not beleaguered.
Yeah, yeah, that are, like the Shia are in Pakistan. I mean, the centrums of this world keep talking about the First Amendment's freedom of religion. But what he talks about really makes me think that we need freedom from religion. And it's exactly the same in this case, where they're talking about, you know, the need for moral exemptions from institutions that take their morality seriously, and somehow the government is forcing them to break their own moral standards. But the price that you pay for that is that everybody is denied. I mean, in other words, you know, they can be exempted, but
right.
they don't want to be exempted. They want to deny everybody else.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of their argumentative rhetorical tactics is to kind of turn church-state separation on its head. So church-state separation is there so that the government does not endorse or appear to endorse a particular religion, a particular faith, a particular religious line of thinking on a policy matter. The argument that they're making here is that the insurance mandate for the contraception coverage is a violation of church-state separation because the government is interfering in the affairs of the church. Now, of course, that would be a constitutional violation if it was true that the government was meddling in the affairs of the church. I mean, the government can't tell the church, you know, what to believe. You know, we don't have a state-run religion here. But the idea that a generally applicable law, which is based on a need, a compelling interest that the government has in keeping the population healthy and alive, is somehow the government telling the church what to do, is just such a stretch. But the other, you know, sort of financial actuarial point to make is that contraception is more cost effective than not providing it, because the cost, you know, even if you weren't to make an argument about women's autonomy or women's reproductive freedom, you know, this is a, from a cost-benefit analysis, you know, this is much, from the insurance company standpoint, it's much cheaper to provide the coverage for the contraception rather than to pay for the coverage for an unintended pregnancy. So, you know, it sort of seems like the insurance companies, although they are complaining about it, probably, you know, shouldn't.
Well, Sarah, I thank you so much for joining us and for filling us in on the ever-changing goalposts here in these culture wars that never seem to be over. Women in this country think that they have a moment to rest on their successes and victories, but that's not the case. They're going to be perpetually on the defensive until... I mean, just in closing, do you think it'd be a good idea for Santorum to be the nominee and for the country to really have a referendum on the real power of the incipient theocratic movement in this country and the religious right? Because my feeling is that if there were such a national referendum, if he were the candidate, we may find out that the religious right's bark is worse than their bite.
Or we might find out the opposite.
Oh, well, then it's not worth not worth taking the chance then. thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Ian. Bye.
Bye. Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, the editor-in-chief of Religion Dispatches and the author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values. Her work has appeared in the American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Spectator, and the religion blogs at The Washington Post and the UK's Guardian. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the nukes for food deal with North Korea. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as the associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Services Committee and a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University. He's also taught at Sung Kong Hyo University in Seoul, South Korea, and his books include Crusade 2.0, The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations, The Imbalance of Power, and North Korea-South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. Thank you for joining us, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on your show.
And this nukes for food deal that... is in the offing between North Korea and the United States. To some extent, we've been there before. What's different about this, do you think?
Well, there are a couple of differences. The first is, of course, that we have a different political leadership in North Korea. It's Kim Jong-un, the youngest son of Kim Jong-il, who died at the end of 2011. And we have a somewhat different political configuration here in the United States as well, since, of course, we really haven't had any agreements between North Korea and the United States during the Obama administration. We have a new envoy, Glenn Davies, who was negotiating this particular agreement. So, to a certain extent, both sides can say, hey, you know, we're a clean slate here. Let's try something new, even if what we're trying sounds a lot like what we did before.
So this deal involves a package of 240,000 metric tons of food assistance to North Korea. And Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, in announcing it, said that there will be intensive monitoring of the aid, which I take it is reflects a concern that food aid might go to the military instead of the starving civilians in North Korea.
There has been that concern in the past. Certainly the United States has insisted repeatedly on very strict monitoring of food assistance. There have been challenges in the past that have been laid at the doorstep of North Korea about diversion of food aid. both to the military as well as to the kind of the political leadership. But I would say a couple of things. Number one, that there's always what's called basically shrinkage or slippage in food assistance anywhere in the world. Sometimes the food ends up on markets, and that certainly has been the case in North Korea. Sometimes it doesn't end up with the neediest people. But for the most part, food assistance that has gone to North Korea has been pretty well monitored when it's gone through the UN food program. Some of the bilateral assistance, on the other hand, bilateral assistance coming from particularly China, is not monitored. So there's really no reason for North Korea to divert food assistance that comes with monitoring requirements when it can basically distribute the food that comes from China anywhere it pleases.
Again, I'm speaking with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. He has been a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and has taught at Sungkyunkwan University in Seoul, South Korea, and is the author of North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. Do you think then, John Pfeffer, that this agreement will lead to the broader six-nation negotiations resuming?
Well, it's possible. I think, frankly, this agreement is in many ways better than an opening round in the six-party talks. Opening rounds and six-party talks generally are just an opportunity for the six countries to make statements, test each other out. It takes a long time for these negotiations to actually produce agreements. But here we have North Korea saying that it'll suspend its uranium production and also suspend its nuclear and missile tests. And I think that's a very important step forward. So if the six parties can build on that momentum, then we might have a much shorter period of time before we get to the next stage in this process.
But it's always been pretty much the North Korean position that they want to deal directly with the United States. And in many ways, they see themselves for their own internal consumption, in spite of the fact that it's an impoverished country that can't feed itself. The people believe that they are standing up to the United States, and the government propaganda is relentlessly portrays the South Korean regime as puppets of the United States who aren't even worth talking to. So I take it that dealing directly with the United States is an important part of North Korean strategy.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not simply because, North Korea wants to present to the people that it's standing up to the United States. It's a very pragmatic kind of analysis of geopolitics. North Korea looks around and says, hey, who's the strongest country in the world? Well, the United States is. It's the primary military superpower in the world. China is nowhere near the United States in terms of its military strength, even though China, of course, is a neighbor of North Korea and sometimes ally of North Korea. So North Korea is saying to itself, well, how do we get out of our predicament? Our predicament being basically economic underdevelopment. We're in a kind of politically challenging situation with a political succession that has just taken place. We have some problematic relations right now with Japan and South Korea. Really, we have to deal with the United States. The United States holds the key in terms of unlocking the dilemma of Northeast Asia. Whatever the United States says, South Korea and Japan are going to follow suit. So I think that's really what North Korea's strategic thinking is at the moment.
Again, I'm speaking with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. He was a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and has taught at Sungkyunkwan University in Seoul, South Korea. And his books include Crusade 2.0, The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations, The Imbalance of Power, and North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. So given that we've we've seen this before, that these food for nukes deals, and the U.S. was supposed to supply also supplement the energy needs of North Korea with fuel. They agreed to shut down the reactor. Then they turned out they had another route to the bomb as well. The same reactor that they'd agreed to shut down, now they are agreeing to shut down again in exchange for this 240,000 metric tons. And they, of course, had tested a nuclear weapon. There's some doubt exactly what they have. The first test was a bit of a dud. The second one seemed to have worked. It's quite possible that they actually have a fairly advanced design for a nuclear warhead that could fit on a missile. They've had also had missile tests in 2009 that provoked UN sanctions. And then in 2010, of course, they unveiled an uranium enrichment facility, giving them a second route to a bomb. The I get the long and the short of it is, John, that it seems to me if they're prepared to give up their nuclear program, which of course obviously the Iranians, the whole world is coming down in Iran over theirs and the extent to which they've declared what they're doing, it seems in many ways that the whole thing has been a bargaining chip all along. Is that possible?
Well, I think that North Korea developed its nuclear weapons for a variety of reasons. One was because they saw nuclear weapons as a status symbol that would indicate to the population and to the world at large that North Korea was a developed nation. I think also that North Korea felt that nuclear weapons served as an important deterrent, especially when, relatively speaking, its conventional strength was deteriorating in comparison to South Korea, and certainly in comparison with the United States and with Japan, that it had to pull some rabbit out of the hat in order to prevent the United States or any other country that might think about regime change through intervention in North Korea from going forward with such a plan. So I think those are two key reasons. A third one, of course, is the relationship between nuclear power and nuclear energy. I mean, you can obviously pursue a civilian nuclear program up to a certain point without going nuclear, and that was an important kind of energy source for North Korea as well, since it only has coal. It doesn't really have any other energy sources, and so nuclear was an important kind of way of becoming independent in an energy sense. So before we even get to the issue of whether the nuclear program is a useful bargaining chip, I think the nuclear program did serve those other purposes. Now, of course, North Korea realized as well that the only reason that countries like the United States were going to pay attention to it, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union and China's kind of decision to move into the global capitalist economy, was if it had a nuclear weapon, that there were plenty of countries around the world that the United States might not like, but would pay no attention to because they simply had nothing that the United States needed or didn't pose a threat to the United States. And the nuclear weapon, of course, posed such a threat. And once they kind of discovered this, they realized that this nuclear program could be a useful bargaining chip. And this came about roughly around the time that the country plunged into a famine in the mid-1990s. And so then the nuclear program becomes a bargaining chip, not only to attract U.S. attention, but to serve as a kind of a ticket, a golden ticket that North Korea could cash in order to kind of jumpstart its economy and leapfrog in its mind over, its current travails and leapfrog into kind of modern capitalist economy. So I think that's kind of the strategic thinking around the nuclear program in Pyongyang.
Well, that, you know, they've done some fairly outrageous things. Fairly recently, sinking a North Korean ship and shelling a South Korean ship and shelling a South Korean island, which certainly, you know, even though there's a lot of sympathy in the South for the North Korean brethren, that was, the second incident was quite shocking. The first incident, some people in the South still don't believe it. There's a pattern here. Is that what just in closing, what you're suggesting, that they do things that are designed to reward them for bad behavior?
Well, you know, there is certainly a tendency to see North Korea as simply kind of behaving irrationally or behaving, you know, in a unacceptable way. But we also have to realize that we've kind of put North Korea into that position, that we, you know, really haven't given it any kind of carrots, any kind of significant outlays of resources in response to good behavior. You know, we've basically ignored North Korea for the most part, and we've insisted that it make its reforms unilaterally without any promise that we'd, you know, help them if they moved in a particular direction. Mm-hmm. And so from North Korea's point of view, it really doesn't have much of a choice. That it can only behave badly in order to attract international attention, to attract U.S. attention. Only bad behavior elicits any kind of response. And that seems to be the case with South Korea as well in the past. So, you know, mm-hmm. ideally, this current deal will kind of change that logic around, and that we will have, you know, a tendency to provide good for good. In other words, further carrots for further kind of changes in North Korean behavior. That hopefully will change the dynamic.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, John Pfeffer.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously worked as the associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. He's been a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and has taught at Sungkyunkwo University in Seoul, South Korea, and his books include Crusade 2.0, The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations, The Imbalance of Power, and North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was